With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Reads Like a Four, the podcast that deals with critics, reviews, and professional criticism. I'm Adam Brooks, and this week my guest is...
Chris Mandel.
Chris is a remarkable guy. At 29 years old, he's now the Entertainment Director of Shortlist, as I expect he'll tell you in a second, which is the UK's biggest men's lifestyle magazine, with over 500,000 copies hitting the streets every week. Let's hear a bit more about him in his own words.
I am entertainment director at Shortlist magazine. Before that, I was features editor at the same title. And before that, I was mainly a freelance writer who contributed to Vice, Esquire, The Independent, Telegraph, and like a handful of other places as well.
There you go. This was a particularly fun episode. My thanks to Chris for being very candid. You're going to hear names dropped from beginning to end, which I think is a good thing. Everything from Timothy Chalamet to Aziz Ansari, Jack Black, Jeff Goldblum, Limmy, and Will.i.am all come up during today's conversation. And you'll also hear that he is, as you'd expect from somebody who interviews stars all the time, a very good interviewee as well. I've never been complimented on as many questions in such a short period of time, so I consider me fully buttered up, basically. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get on with the episode, and let's hear from Chris. My first question was, I thought I'd go straight in with Shortlist. How does Shortlist decide what to cover, review and feature? What are the sort of criteria? What are the questions you ask?
That's a really good question. Just as a bit of background, we work on about 6 to 8 issues at any one time. So that means that we're constantly thinking, we're constantly looking at things, we're constantly going to see films before they're out, we're constantly listening to albums, and we're constantly thinking, like, what can we do. So a big part of it is just making sure we're exposed to as much as possible, and that we're able to, you know, our job is to sort of be a few steps ahead of our readers and make sure that tell them about a documentary that they're probably going to be obsessed with, or a Netflix show that they're going to be obsessed with. So one of the first things we do is just kind of like, are we into it? Do we think this is exciting? Is this something that we can't stop talking about? Because if we can't stop talking about Wild Wild Country, which is this amazing Netflix documentary about cults,
which I'm literally due to start tonight,
right?
Yeah,
well, we've got to talk about it when you've started, because it's one of those things that everybody in the office is talking about it. And that's not just writers talking to writers, but I'm talking to our art department about it, our fashion team, our people in sales. And if we're having those conversations, then by that logic, everybody is. So we do a lot of that. We just see what is out there. And then sometimes it's a little bit more. One of the things I love about being on print is that you get a little bit of intuition. And the great thing about being free is that nobody is saying to you, that cover didn't sell. Every time we put Matt Damon on the cover, we do really well, so let's just do him every month. Like, you have a much more intuition, so you're not feeling like you can't take risks, basically.
Okay, so it's not such a direct relationship that a cover, you can tell a particular cover hasn't been picked up, and that doesn't affect ad rates.
No,
it doesn't really work in that way.
Not really, no. I mean, I keep quite separate from how the sort of commercial side works. I think as a free magazine, and I don't know what it's like on paid for titles at the moment, we feel it's really important that we are separate, and that we're having conversations separately, and that we're not, you know, writing for advertorials, or that we're, you know, kind of crossing over. And I don't know if that's because we're free that we're more conscious of it, or if that's something that everybody's feeling at the moment. But everybody is setting up a content studio in-house. Everyone is doing the kind of product stuff for brands. So I don't really get involved in too much of the stuff to see how stuff does, how many copies get shifted. But sometimes it's as simple as, like, if it rains, the magazine might not get picked up because the stack by the tube is wet. So we try not to. When I used to work in other print media, like my first job was at FHM. That was my first staff position. There was this, like, men's mag law where, like, green didn't sell. So you never did green on the cover. There's no green. Orange was great. Blue, brilliant. Red, really good. And there was just some things you didn't do. And every now and then you would get people that would be like, oh, come on, we haven't done green for ages. And then you do it and it bombs and they go, that was because it was green. But you don't know if it was because it was green. It could have been because the person on the cover wasn't as famous, or the person on the cover was too exposed. You know, there's so many things.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could even argue that it's more likely to get the green issue out the door if there's someone on it that's pretty low stakes.
Yeah. Because then you blame green.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Talking about covers in general, you mentioned before we got on the call that covers are decided months in advance.
Yeah.
Does that ever prevent you from putting someone or something urgent on, or someone who's had a sort of meteoric rise? Do you ever, or do you bump planned covers if something huge comes in?
We sometimes do move stuff. I mean, what we often do is, you know, it's twofold. So we know, for example, that there's a Star Wars film out next December. So we're always thinking, okay, when that comes around, who would we do? And, you know, it might be somebody like John Boyega, who's never had a cover before. I imagine we'll have a conversation like that. So you kind of, you get your big things lined up, and then you always have room to do smaller things. I mean, we don't do a famous person on the cover every week. We tend to do two, maybe three a month. And that means that we have a bit of flexibility. We did Timothy Chalamet on the cover in February. And even 3 months prior, we didn't know how meteoric his ascent was going to be around award season. The Oscar nomination was a big part of the decision because he was promoting another film, but he had a very small part in it. So that was someone who's even 6 months before that cover, we weren't really aware of who he was. But you see this thing happening and you go, right, he might get nominated for an Oscar. We should really have a plan in place. And that kind of came together beautifully. I think if we were going to do him in 6 months' time, it would feel like a bit done. So we do have room to react, and we don't just book up. We try and get a couple of things in a month and always have room to do something more reactionary, someone younger. It's not all film stars as well. Musicians will do slightly nearer the time as well.
It sounds almost like placing aggregator bets sometimes. Yeah. If this thing comes in and this thing comes in, then this will be a huge cover.
Yeah.
Just to go back to your sort of your writing life before Shortlist, you've obviously worked for a ton of publications. I've got a list here, and I'll have mentioned it in the intro to this episode.
Okay.
Either as a staffer or a freelancer, how did decisions around what they chose to cover and what they commissioned you to write affect how you make those same kind of decisions now?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the big things the thing that I find at Shortlist is that we're not any of the other people, and our kind of metrics for what we want to do has always been really different to, like, Esquire, for example. When I used to do a bit of work at Esquire in 2013, I was in the office, I would come in for freelance cover. And I remember one year they had six men and six women, and that was considered like a sort of standard, you know, men did well, women did well. And then it's sort of completely changed. It's men seem to do a lot more now, and it's the same with GQ. They are still doing women on the cover, but that seems to be a big change. Shortlist, we don't really do women on the cover, for the simple fact that we have never been a straight man's magazine, and we've never been marketed to, like, men that want to admire women in a certain way. And that means that we don't put women on the cover. I mean, we did do them at one point, but it was always bikinis, it was always sexy, it was always, like, licking their lips, and it just felt like, actually, the benefit of being free is that you're not trying to market to a particular heteronormative guy. So we've always just done guys. We felt like we weren't doing women justice, and I don't think many men's publications do, to be completely honest. I'm gay, so I don't really get the appeal in seeing a woman, like, naked, like, shirtless or whatever on a magazine. So that's been a big thing. And then just quickly, I guess there's always been things that I'd see people doing things and think, I love the way that I used to do stuff at Dazed. I loved the way that they would make someone a bit of a star. And by putting them in Dazed when they were quite young, that would bring a certain bit of gravitas. So we often have cover stars that might be big in 6 months' time, or they might be big next year, or And I really like that because there's a sense of a bit more ownership over it. If you style someone in a certain way and you kind of go, this is a young person you've never seen yet, but you will see them everywhere. Like, I really like that kind of seal of approval.
Do you think some of those situations where you're putting perhaps a younger sort of ascending star on the cover, the idea is that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, that by the act of putting them on the cover, that may be the thing that ensures that they become a big deal in, you know, certainly in the UK market?
I think definitely. I think a lot of what I'm finding now is a lot of LA publicists know that there's not an equivalent in the US of Shortlist. There's not a version of a weekly kind of like higher end men's magazine that's also like kind of doing music and concert. So what we're finding is quite a lot of people pitch people as part of the broader strategy to get onto American GQ a couple of years later. We've done people like Ansel Elgort, who was the star of Baby Driver last year, the Edgar Wright film. And when that was coming out, I'm pretty sure a lot of our readers didn't know who he was. When we went to shoot him, you know, we weren't all like, oh my God, it's him. Because he was doing young adult films. He was doing a lot of like society magazines because he's from like rich stock. But
right,
part of what we can do is we can go, right, pick this up, trust us, there's a good story here, this guy's interesting, we're going to tell you why, and it's not as if you have to like click, because no one's having to look at it on a newsstand and go, am I going to enjoy this, am I going to read this, am I going to get my money's worth? So there is a different relationship. I think sometimes it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't want us to always be doing people that no one's heard of, you know, or if we are going to do people, I want that to be done in such a way that it looks irresistible. We did the lead in Steven Spielberg's film Ready Player One in March. He's a lad called Ty Sheridan. He's been in a few indie films. I don't think a lot of people knew who he was at that point, but we did a shoot in Austin where he's from. We went to his hometown. We shot him in a junkyard in like high-end tracksuits, and whether you knew who he was or not, I think that cover was really strong, and I think you go, okay, this looks interesting, I haven't seen this before, which helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the junkyard aesthetic matches the film as well, so there's a connection to be made
there. Just subtly enough as well, though. We don't want it to be too kind of hit them over the head. And he had a t-shirt saying press start in like analog thing, and which is a very, very unsubtle, but it's also APC, and APC is a brand that we think is cool. So it's kind of, you're kind of, yeah, there's allusions, certainly, like,
and it sounds like it could have been a lot more on the nose, you know, if you've got him in an Atari t-shirt with a Mario hat,
oh my God,
you know, sat on a shipping container. When Shortlist began, I remember it launching. I lived in London at the time, and when it launched in London, it felt like it was positioned, or it was taken by the public, initially at least, as a magazine for men, but also a point of difference to a lot of kind of lads mags and sort of supposedly highbrow culture mags full of expensive ads for watches and so on. Most of those magazines are largely gone now.
Yeah.
So, or have dwindling readership. So does that change who and what Shortlist is for? Have you basically absorbed some of the readership of those magazines and then broadened as a result?
It's a really interesting question, because I think what our reader is always going to be changing. But we know that we are making content for young men, but it is kind of like late 20s, 30s. I'm 29, so I think it's my age and a little bit older. But, you know, we've got teams that do all the market research on who gets it, who the ads are for. And it is genuinely your like city, kind of cosmopolitan, forward thinking, metropolitan male. However, I have always said, being on the editorial side, whoever is at that tube station at that point with at least one hand free can get that magazine and read it and enjoy it. And I think, you know, we are seeing, you know, we're picking up a lot. Yeah, the circulation has been going up ever since we launched. I think it's like 505,000 a week now, and that wouldn't be possible if we weren't constantly like aware of who's getting it. But I think, just to get back to your question, I think it's a bit of everything, because I think as a 29-year-old on a moderate salary, there are some times when I want something really high end. Like I will spend a lot on certain things, and there's some things I won't. And I think our magazine is constantly like mobile, and it's malleable, because we're not going to go, you should spend 40 grand on this chair. And we don't do a lot on cars, for example, but if we do something on cars, we did a motoring issue last year, which was a sort of like a bit of a test project to see if we do one more often. We did really cool photography of the cup holders in some of the most expensive cars in the world, because it's not about whether you're going to go buy one in the weekend. It's more like, well, our readers aren't going to get to sit in one. So what do the cup holders look like? And some of them look really fancy. So I think mm-hmm. it's really cool, like taking a really high-end thing and looking at it in a slightly less high-end way. And I think that constant kind of umming and like toing and froing is a big part of how Shortlist works.
Mm-hmm. Earlier in your career, you wrote a lot about gaming and about music. Mm-hmm. What are the key differences in terms of what people are looking for from record and game reviews yeah. and how each one's treated?
It's a really good question. Music has changed so much now, because I think anybody with an internet connection is able to kind of access the most intelligent opinions on the most interesting aspects of anything. I mean, if Kanye West puts out an album on Friday, for example, by Saturday, you know, across Twitter, you will find like amazing things, amazing opinions and amazing angles to something. A Kanye album, there'll be the way that The Ringer covers it and the way the Sunday Times covers it and the way GQ covers it and the way we cover it is all completely different. I think a big change for music is that no one is waiting for your one opinion, because it used to be, I used to do reviews for NME. You would go out and buy the magazine, you would open it, and it would be a very comprehensive digest. Now, I mean, I do think opinion journalism and criticism like that is changing. And with Shortlist, we've never positioned ourselves as critics in the same way. We don't review things out of 10. We don't give scores at all. In fact, we talk about things in slightly different ways, you know.
It almost feels like the review in terms of Shortlist is just whether it's chosen to be yeah. covered at all.
Yeah, because we don't want to shit all over something, because it's just, first of all, I think it's actually really lazy, very easy. If you've got something like the Emoji Movie, which everybody knew was going to be bad, everybody knew it was corporate cash out, like the cast was like James Corden, you know, there wasn't really anything redeeming in there. All the people that went to the press screening to see it for free and slagged it off, I don't think there was any really intelligent thing in that. It was just, yeah, like, we know there's a turd emoji in it. Like, you saying the film is turd is like not the most hot take. And I think negative journalism, not to say you shouldn't be negative, by the way, mm-hmm. but kind of piling in on something and not taking it somewhere further is like just not working at the moment. And I feel like, as you say, with Shortlist, if we put something in, there's a bit of an endorsement. But, you know, we will do a film write-up where we'll talk only about Nicolas Cage's hair, or we will do, as we did with the last Wes Anderson film, Isle of Dogs, it was an imagined conversation between him and his wife. And I think we do get tweets from people that are like, I don't see anyone writing about stuff like this. And that's not to say we're better than it than anyone else, but I think we just don't want to be part of this, like, we're chin strokey armchair critics that I see everyone do it, and I just don't find any of it particularly interesting. You know, I find the notion of gig reviews in 2018 completely mind-blowing, because if I wasn't there, I don't care what someone who didn't pay to see it thinks of it. I just find it like I'm never going to be in that particular moment. So, and in terms of gaming, I think actually what's really difficult is the challenge is to write for people who don't game all the time. You have to almost write for people that speak gaming as a second language, not a first. And we have a lot of casual gamers. We have a lot of readers who have a Switch, and they have a lot of mobile gaming, and they, you know, have a Nintendo DS or whatever, and PlayStations. But those guys are already talking on a whole other level about gaming, and we can't do what gaming magazines do. So again, it's like we did a story in our front section. We do two gaming issues a year, so one to two every year. We did a thing on like the prettiest sunsets in this summer's hottest games, which was just a gorgeous kind of spread, a really visual story just about, hey, sunsets look really nice in games at the moment. And I think that's it, picking something out like that is just for me the best way to cover these kind of things, because if your reader is into Nintendo, they know whether they're gonna buy the new game or not. They don't need you to say to them, hey, I liked it. Like if they've got a Switch, they're gonna want, you know. So I think the role of us and the role of the journalist is less about helping someone make the decision. I think it's about providing analysis and context, and a bit like Genius, how you go on Genius and it tells you what the lyrics mean. It's about mm-hmm. insight into things they're already consuming rather than helping them decide whether to consume something or not.
Yeah. You're the person that shortlists deciding the entertainment strategy. Mm-hmm. You're the person writing features on James Franco and Jeff Goldblum, Aziz Ansari and so on, liaising with publicists, labels and studios. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you allow conditions to be attached to those high profile interviews? How often do they come in?
Yeah.
And is there a point with restrictions that you say this is handing over too much control yeah. of the access and the article?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I don't know what it's like for people who don't work in the industry or what their preconceptions are. Before I worked in journalism, I just assumed you would ring Amy Winehouse and say, can we interview you? And you just go and do that. So we have certain standards. We have certain levels of access we require for a cover story. And the rule is, if you don't want to do that, you don't get a cover. You go inside. We shoot all of our covers now. That's a decision that we made about 2 years ago, nearly. Because we weren't spending on shoots, we weren't going for people. And that really radically changed how we do covers, because say if you've got someone like Ryan Gosling, who is not coming over to the UK, he would say, well, I'll give you a 30-minute interview and you can buy a picture of me. That can run as a cover. We were not getting any insight into Ryan Gosling that everyone else hadn't already got. We wouldn't be the first people to interview. So we changed our tact and we said, we have to shoot everybody. That's the rule. If you want a shortlist cover, you have to put the work in. You have to work with us creatively. And we have minimum sort of amount of exposure. So we would ask for a minimum of 60 minutes for a shoot and a minimum of 60 minutes for an interview. Most people actually do go beyond that, because in those 2 years, we've kind of, I think, established that we know what we're doing. Like, we're doing something good. We're doing something very different that no one else in the market is doing, in terms of they're very, very colorful covers. They're very loud and there's lots of character. There's no suiting. There's no black and white. There's no sitting on a fence crying or anything. No one is supposed to look like they're going to a funeral, is the rule. Mm-hmm. So now that we've sort of established what we want to do, people are generally quite good. We tend to not have publicists present, which is initially that was harder to get through than we would have anticipated. And to be completely honest with you, because I don't think there's any point doing this unless you are completely honest, some people have sat in on interviews and I'm really annoyed about it. But you sometimes go, how is this going to affect what the reader's getting? Maybe they don't like whatever. So we have had people sit in. Generally, I say, this is a 49-year-old man who's got 3 kids. He can look after himself. Like, I will mention there's a publicist there, or if he, you know, is struggling to answer a question, and he can say no comment. He can say, I don't want to answer that. I will write that in, but you've got to train your clients how to say no to questions. Like, that's your job. So we have rules about that, because I think what I want our cover stories to do generally is to offer a bit of insight into who this person is at this particular moment. So we do 50 issues a year. We don't always get exclusives. James Franco did NME, and I think he did maybe one of the Saturday, maybe the Times, I think. We don't always get exclusives. We sometimes do, but we don't always. So we don't want to try and ever offer the definitive story. It's not like, well, it all started in 1983, and then he did this, and then he did this, because you can read that on the internet. You can read that in the interviews that someone gives at any one time. So I really want us to just tell a very specific story about where they are in that time. Some magazines, particularly in the US, they go bungee jumping with their people, and like Vanity Fair, Selena Gomez went and cooked at the journalist's house, and they get this insane access, and we don't get that. Okay. But I think there's nothing wrong with cutting your cloth accordingly and saying, look, we're not bungee jumping, we're not cooking with anyone, we're not playing, you know, a round of golf with Robert Pattinson. This is what we have done. So we, as long as we can, one of the things we say when we're putting someone on the cover is, we like this person because they have something to say. So they need to want to talk to us. There was a cover, I probably shouldn't name who it is because I might get in trouble, but there was a cover we were going to do last year that we pulled because they rejected 5 different pitches for a concept. They wanted to wear their own clothes. They wanted to be shot. They wanted to decide who the photographer was. they wanted like half an hour to just grab some pictures, like portraiture, which we don't really do that much. And like, it was getting so frustrating that we said, I think what you want and what we do are incompatible, and I think you'd actually be better going to another publication. Didn't go down very well because nobody wants to get sort of dumped like that. But there was also, there was a musician last year who, again, I probably can't name because we are reopening discussions with them at the moment, but okay, they wanted a cover and it was like, you can get a 10-minute shoot and can you do the interview on the phone? And we just, I said, no. I said, I don't think it's asking a lot for this person to do an hour. And bearing in mind that even before I worked there, you know, we shot Kendrick Lamar a few years ago. We've done this in terms of musicians, like we do get high profile people. And we often say, well, if he'll sit down for an hour, anyone less famous should want to do it. And like, so we kind of, I wasn't happy with this. I wasn't happy with the idea of a phone chat because I want to know what this person looks like in the flesh, because our readers want to know that. And I want to know what his eye contact is like. I want to know where he looks. I want to know what his hair's like up close, because we are going to be sitting next to someone our readers won't get to sit next to. And I really like telling that to people, that this is what their posture's like and this is what they smell like, because that's the sort of stuff I'd want to know if I met someone, you know. So we kind of pulled this musician because it was like a case of, you're not willing to do the work that other people do, and if we start letting people on the cover with 10 minutes, it undermines all the people that put an hour in or 2 hours in some cases. So we have standards that you should always be malleable, but we do have rules.
Yeah. And I guess the way that you go about features in terms of, you know, spending a finite amount of time with somebody, but kind of focusing on a specific period.
Yeah.
Prevents you from having to talk about X big controversy that happened 15 years ago in their lives that they're always asked a question about. Exactly. Right at the end, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we always try and get them. What I like is, you know, if you treat somebody with the basic level of respect, which is, you know, this is different to brown nosing them, but when you treat someone with a basic level of respect, they are more likely to have those difficult conversations with you at the end. When we did Timothy Chalamet, we ran our cover 2 weeks after he did the Sunday Times culture cover, and there was an issue where the Sunday Times had asked about him donating his fee from his Woody Allen film to Time's Up and an LGBT right. charity. It was considered inappropriate to ask because Timothy had put a statement up about it. And, you know, the idea was he'd said what he needed to say. And it was a really difficult conversation to have. And actually during that period, the sort of in Hollywood, at least, they were sort of saying he's not speaking out about it that much because the people that vote at the Oscars, a lot of them might still agree that Woody Allen and the situation with him currently was a bit of a witch hunt. So people were saying it was a very calculated move, and that's why he wouldn't want to elaborate or really like verbally like put Woody Allen down. The Times did ask him about it and it went quite sour, and they were kind of, it didn't end particularly well. And I was told by a source that they had been blacklisted by this agency that look after Timothy and a bunch of other people from working with them again. That was like a rumor that was going around. So I was due to interview him, and you know, I was like, I can't not ask about Woody Allen. And it's really difficult because I don't want to not ask, but I've seen it kind of almost firsthand how this has gone. But we ended up having three conversations, two of which were on the phone after our shoot because he had to go back to LA. We had this initial meeting, two more chats, and on the last one, it was about midnight in the UK, and I kind of knew that this was our last chance together. And I just asked him, and he gave me a really good answer, and his team didn't mind. And so I think controversy and just generally asking difficult questions, there's a way to do it. But I think there was a John Hamm profile in American Esquire last month. And they bring up he must be what, like 46 or 48, I guess. They bring up this incident when he was at school, when he was at college, where he was part of a fraternity that like really badly beat up a guy. I actually didn't know about it, but if you read the profile, John, it makes it quite clear that he constantly gets asked about it, and it comes up in every interview. Right. And, you know, it happened to him, say, like 30 years ago almost. If you've got quotes out there from him on that, I don't see the value in asking him again, because if you asked me about the time I did something really, really, like the time I smoked at secondary school by the bike sheds, if you asked me that every year since, I'd be like, look, I've fucking told you everything you need to know. So, which also is worth mentioning, one of the things I would do if we're going to do a profile, read everything they've done. Mm-hmm. And actually, what have they not said? And what does what they've not said tell us? And what is what they've not spoken about so far? Is there anything we can glean from that? That's a good way to go. But it can be hard, yeah. Because I think ultimately you spend a lot of time in someone's company. It's really difficult to, you know, feel like you're betraying them. But ultimately you are making something for your reader. And
yeah,
also if you ask difficult questions in the right way, I don't think they mind. I don't think if you do it appropriately, I don't think it's a problem.
And it's very evident if you're a reader, especially reading a kind of an in-depth feature, a cover feature, when there's something that is clearly the topic of the day,
yeah,
as far as that interview goes, and it's not asked about, and you know that's because they've been, you know, it's been shoehorned out of the interview by a publicist, mm-hmm, or by conditions to get the interview in the first place, and so it just kind of feels like a very obvious elephant in the room type situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess as well, like you're saying, the example with John Hamm, it must feel to him like trying to stamp out a pandemic, you know, because yeah, every quote he uses is used the next time a journalist goes to, exactly, figure out what to ask him, exactly, and so the process must repeat forever.
He even says in the piece, I didn't know this was going to be a hit piece, which I think is, you know, he's clearly gone, oh shit, this is one of those interviews where they trap you. So I also think if we can find those interviews where they've already talked about it, our readers probably can as well. We can reference stuff. Sometimes if you get, say you get 60 minutes with someone, you really can't use that time asking stuff that they've already talked about at length.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, yeah. Who's been the most surprising interviewee in terms of you having hugely under or overestimated them prior to meeting them?
That's a really good question. Underwhelming was probably Aziz Ansari. He's someone that I really, really championed for a cover when, you know, I loved Master of None season one. When I knew it was coming back, I think we kind of worked on, it was about 7 months prior, we kind of went, we've got to do Aziz. And actually when my editor, I had an editor, Joe Makatich, he started June 2016. So I had an editor prior to him joining. When he started, we sat down and we put together like a sort of dream kind of, if we could get any of these guys, this would be amazing. And I think it was about seven people, two of whom I've decided were terrible ideas and they've been scratched off. But the other five, as of 3 weeks ago, we just shot the last one on that list, and it was an amazing feeling that we, and one of those was Aziz, so that was where I was going with that. So we did him and we shot him in a hotel in London, and he was really fun on the shoot. The shoot was him kind of like he trashed a hotel room, so we got a stylist, like a prop stylist, to, we had this room for 2 hours 1 hour of which was the shoot. So this woman had like half an hour prior to like wreck the place and then position Aziz in it, get all these shots, and then unwreck it in half an hour after. And the interview was great. The shoot was great. I really liked the photo shoot. He was so up for it. He was playing golf off a sofa. He was throwing pizza. It was really fun. Because up to that point, everybody had been putting him in formal wear to be like, look, this kind of, you don't see that every day. And I kind of was sick of seeing him. So he was in streetwear. He's in Adidas tracksuit. We got to the interview and he was really jet lagged. He was lying down for quite a lot of it, looking at the ceiling. It was kind of like being his therapist because I was sitting to like a right angle. And the first thing he did was take my notebook off me and read all my questions. So I was a bit like, oh, come on. Like, and he did it under the pretense of like, oh, you've got lovely handwriting. And he just read everything. So I decided to not ask him anything that was written down. So I just went, right, well, if you're going to do that, then. But I just, he was not as forthright as I expected. And he wasn't as outgoing as I expected. But what I would say is one thing I've learned doing the job is that it's the wrong outlook for you to expect your subjects to be these kind of like cartwheeling, like joke spewing, like, because regular people aren't like that. And I think what I learn and what I've learned from working for certain editors and what I've learned from writing features is that you can't cede control of your story by putting all your faith in this person being a one-man show. And if that person is grumpy and if they're difficult and if they're quiet, that's fine, because your job is to almost report and explain this person to your readers. So it becomes a story of, well, why is the most in-demand, charismatic guy in the world like so quiet? And why is this guy looking like he would rather be anywhere else? And that becomes the story. But it does mean that I came away from the experience feeling a bit like, oh man, this guy, I really thought he was going to be kind of, you know, because again, like we did him and I think FT did him, you know, it wasn't like he was doing 18 interviews. So he was one where I felt like the illusion was sort of shattered, but I still maintain that that's fine. The other one, the reverse of that for me, I think it would be Jeff Goldblum, which is one that I think is one of the better known cover stories that I did. The pictures kind of blew up and were being discussed all over the internet, and we still get messages from people that are like, oh, like at Christmas, loads of fans made Christmas tree angels out of the magazine pages, which was really cool. I was assigned to do that quite late because I just got back from Toronto, and then like 2 days later I had to go to LA. Somebody else, one of my colleagues, has had visa problems, and I'm not a huge kind of Jurassic Park kind of Goldblum fanatic, so I was kind of going into it not quite getting like his kind of omnipresent, like, you know, I didn't get the thing. But it kind of helped because I wasn't like, none of the questions were about The Fly or like any of his work. It ended up just being this conversation with him. I mean, about a third of the whole piece is him just describing how he gets ready in the morning, because it was just so funny. He tells you everything in so precisely, and I came away, he's magical. He's like a genie, like this live tanned like man that's just so wonderful, and like everybody was just enamored by him. So that was a big one for me, because it really changed my perception of him, and it was, he means a lot to different generations of men, which isn't always the case with our readers. My dad thought that was really cool, like some of my older friends. So those were two where my own experiences where I was quite surprised in different ways. The other one I wanted to mention is we did Jack Black in December for Jumanji. Jumanji, I mean, it's not going to win an Oscar for acting, you know, reboot hysteria is quite common. Jack Black has been on the cover before, but hardly in his prime. Someone that we were like, we think this is really cool, but, you know, I was still kind of not quite sure. And the interview was really good. Just, I got a writer, Ralph Jones, who's one of our staff writers. I got him to do it, and he is what made it good. The two of them together were what made it work. So someone that on paper you go, I don't get it, I don't know if there's a really big story here, he met Jack three times during this trip to Barcelona. We went out to Barcelona to do the shoot, and that was a big part of the story. It was the, I met three Jack Blacks while I was in Barcelona, and it and that, I really loved that. So I think that made me go, yeah, this guy's great, and you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting as well, because Jack Black is one of those people I would almost have put into the same kind of feelings that you had about Aziz. Like, right. I've seen interviews with him where, you know, you're expecting him to be always on, yeah. to be this kind of, you know, hilarious sort of almost like Robin Williams-esque exactly. character. And some people have caught him on a real off day. So, yeah, it's interesting to hear this kind of the facets of his personality come out.
Comedians, generally, I would say, comedians, you know, they are performing just as much as actors. And if you don't expect Tom Cruise to be hanging off a helicopter in real life, then you shouldn't expect comedians to be funny in real life. I think that's my
yeah.
take on it.
Do you, talking about the kind of the Aziz thing, and you talking about, you know, that ultimately you're reporting on what you find, do you ever feel that it's part of your job to extract the fun out of the person you're talking to? If you've got someone who's kind of dour, do you need to shape your questions to make them an entertaining
yeah. It's really
read?
Interesting, because what you have to do is it's like choose your own adventure. And like, I never understood this until after I started writing, but you can't just write your questions. You have to then, it's branching off. Okay, if that goes badly, like, how am I going to save it? And if this goes well, and we can only going to get him to talk about this if this works. And if he hates this conversation, then he's going to hate this. But what I would say is sometimes you can overplan, and sometimes flying by the seat of your pants is better, because I always try and think, like, you know, famous people aren't like you or I. They are different, but you still have to treat them like they're quite normal, and you have to talk to them like you would talk to normal people. And what I've learned is that quite a lot of people have, you know, will say that they just hate the way people blow smoke up their ass, you know? And, mm. And like, I interviewed Tom Holland, who is the third Spider-Man. And he was saying, everybody loves me. And like, everybody is, you know, such a big fan. And I'm a big fan of several comic book films, including Spider-Man, and he was like, do you know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, but I said, you know, some of those films aren't good, so, you know, you're just as likely to be, like, you know, unpopular. And I think if you kind of remove yourself from, like, I need to tell them what they want to hear, I think that really helps. But I think generally you've got to just extract as much as you can about anything. And I love it if you interview an actor and the conversation is entirely about one thing, that's interesting. You can make it about that. I interviewed Bill Hader, the former SNL cast member. It's for next week's issue. It's inside. It's not a cover story. We had an hour on the phone, and we kept coming back to this anxiety that he has. He has really bad anxiety, really bad self-esteem issues, really bad stress levels. And he would say to me that when he was doing SNL, he was constantly having, like, hyperventilating off the side of the stage, and then he'd go on and he'd become this, like, you know, bouncy kind of whatever. So in fact, the whole feature has ended up being a piece about how to stay zen by the least zen man in Hollywood, basically. And I think I did not know that was going to be like that until 10 minutes in of this 60-minute chat. I was like, this is a great idea to just focus it a bit. So sometimes I just think the best thing to do is just not plan too much and like, not wing it, that sounds awful, but just be open to how it goes.
Yeah, not have a fully written flowchart
yeah.
before you go in. I had a couple of things I wanted to ask, just more sort of general questions. One is that of things that you perhaps did, or a style that you would write in when you were starting out, do you use anything that you used to do as an example to people of what not to do now? Is there a pitfall that you fell into earlier in your career that you now advise people against?
There's one thing, actually, and once you see it, you will see it everywhere. And it's my editor's pet peeve, and it became my pet peeve, and it's something I used to always do, which is, there's a couple of things. First of all, saying someone is not how you'd imagine in the films, like whether someone's really serious in real life and they're funny, or vice versa. You always see it in profiles. It's like, hey, it turns out this really serious guy is a barrel of laughs, as if they were going to be like murdering people.
He's an actor. Who knew? Yeah.
And then you also get, he's just as funny as he is on, you know, like, okay, everybody is funny when they're trying to impress you. That's the rule, right? An actor who is trying to promote their 3 or 4 out of 5 film is going to turn the charm on. They're going to, laughing is another one. This is something I cut out of copy. If you go, here's a big paragraph about how they laugh. Like, okay, the way they laugh is not as interesting as you think, especially if they're going to laugh at everything you say. Like, and that's what people do, because they're trying to charm you. So I always get rid of laugh references. I always get rid of megawatt smile, because anyone in Hollywood gets their teeth fixed. Just assume we know they've got a big, lovely smile with big white.
Yeah. And it's like saying that, it's like saying they walked in with 2 working arms.
Yeah.
Almost.
He has a left foot and a right foot, which is really interesting. You know, Limmy, the comedian Limmy, always does that thing when someone dies where he goes,
oh yeah,
I had the pleasure of meeting him. Very funny and surprisingly down to
earth. Surprisingly down to earth.
That is it. That makes me think of Limmy every time. So I always get rid of that. I think that the describing what someone's eating is awful, because it's always chips. It's always, if it's a woman, it's, oh my God. And she's eating triple cooked chips, and she models for Prada. How does she do it? Like, it's bullshit. And there's no, and like, yeah. I think there's ways to do food eating that's not that obvious. That's not that sort of boring. So there's those, just cliches are, you know, just anything that feels like you got it out of the book of phrases. There's any kind of words where I feel like you wouldn't use that when you talk to your friends. So why are you talking to our readers like that? But that is part of the reason. The shortlist is very sort of, you know, the references have got to be really, really modern. And also, you can't, it's kind of on a level. We're not Vogue. Like, we're not, you know. So there's stuff like that. And then I think in general writing that's not interview based, I think actually the worst crime is just sticking to a sort of cut and paste formula. I love it when someone just has the confidence to start in a really random place but make it work. And there's been a couple of people I'll have commissioned before who they'll do a very diligent job interviewing someone, but I know how it's going to go. I know that they're going to start with this long paragraph, and then it goes, you might think it's weird that this person's eating chips, given that they've just, and you know, and then you get this, and then you get a quote about Me Too, and you get a quote about Trump, and you get a thing about how much they laugh, and then it ends, and it's like, I'm £400 out of pocket, and you've just sent me the most, a computer could have written that. So I try to just say, please no cliches, please no boring. I could go on about this for so long.
Yeah,
I have a sort of very informal list of commandments that I send to writers, where it's like, try and say something that's going to make them uncomfortable. Try and get them to say something you wouldn't expect. And you'd be surprised how few people do that. You'd be surprised how few times people want to really say, what do you actually want to know from this person? You can't just say, what was it like working with the Coen brothers? Because they're not going to say it was shit. They're going to say, oh, it was great, I love the Coen brothers. Or if you say, who are you desperate to work with? Well, that's not going to be interesting, is it? Unless they say,
and I guess,
Woody Allen.
I guess it's like, it's a shame that people might feel that it's a triumph if they get out the other end of an interview and think, oh, well, you know, that went smoothly. Mm. You know, smoothly, it's such a non-result.
Yeah, you want them to remember it for the right reasons. But I think also the way that people are used to talking to famous people for work does come down to something which I tell new writers and old writers to do, which is, you've got to remember that you're not there to be their friend, okay? You can get on, but if you're going to interview them and then send them a fucking tweet later and just try to connect, that is not what you're there to do. You're there to explain this person to our readers, because they're not doing that. So I think that's a big problem. I think we as people so desperately want to be liked that it's very, very hard to meet someone famous and not just have a nice, polite chit chat. I think also, I do think that the way that the media is getting smaller, more intimate, and I think that, you know, there was a while where journalism was quite a crude sort of job. People didn't like journalists. People didn't like the press. There is this attempt at like, look, hey, ooh, we're not like those guys. We're not News of the World. Like, we're cool. And I think you can just stop asking the relevant stuff. So I think that's a big problem, is just a really understandable but irritating need to be pals with them.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, and you see it so much. So we're almost at the end. One thing I do at the end of every episode is delve back into each writer's body of work and pull out some choice phrases. So I've got five phrases. Some of these are you, some of these are not you. So I want to see if you recognize your own voice here. The first one's quite long, which will hopefully make it a bit easier. So here we go. Number one. But every now and then, the man with a website URL for a name hits the nail on the head, and his opinions manage to actually be spot on. It's a bit like the annual event where salmon leap up a river. Some of them fail miserably, landing on the riverbank and being eaten by bears in the process, but some salmon make it to the top of the river and breed copiously.
Okay, that was a piece I wrote for The Mirror about Will.i.am.
That's right.
And it was because he said, let me try and think... He said something like, the voice isn't here to make them famous. It's just there to provide the platform for them to then make themselves famous, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think the piece...
I think you're right, because everyone was bashing the voice for not producing a hit.
And he was like, it's up to them. And it's like, well, why are you getting paid to mentor them if you're only going to do it for 6 weeks? I mean, you know. And he produced a song for someone who won the voice, and it did terribly. So, you know... That's a good start.
We're one for one. Number two. But it's only now the show has tied its characters' lives into this destructive cycle of blackmail, murder and corruption, and though nobody has come off from it very well, it only adds to the captivatingly bleak environment.
Okay, I think that is a review of True Detective that I did for The Independent.
It is.
Yeah! I don't know what episode, but I reviewed 4 episodes for them at the end of the season out of 8. And I had to get up, I had to watch it in the US, in US time. So I had to watch it at like 3 a.m. while it was simulcast on Sky, write it up. But then I was also working in the office. So I had to then get 2 more hours sleep and then go in. Oh my God, it just wasn't worth it in the end.
Well, certainly not for series 2 of True Detective. All right, number 3. Not having arrived today with any sort of agenda, she apparently simply fancies a chat. So a chat is what we have.
I don't think that is me. I almost feel like I recognize that, and I think it got posted today on the internet. Would that be right?
I don't think so. Oh. No.
I don't think that is me, but now I'm wondering if that's not true.
Okay. Well, I'll take your first answer. Okay. You're right. It's not okay. You. That was it was Peter Robinson writing about Lord in The Guardian some time ago.
I read that yesterday, and that's why it felt recent.
Okay, yeah, I think it's from a while back, but
it's a really good interview, that, because he's really open about how kind of she challenges him quite a lot, and I think that difficult relationship they have is something that I love to see in interviews.
Yeah, absolutely. Number 4, it's quite a long one again. Okay. Whether the judging panel feel Sheeran's success is so immense and so era-defining that it can't be ignored, even his loudest detractors would have their work cut out arguing he hasn't proved hugely influential judging by the charts, or they genuinely feel his skill as an unashamedly popular songwriter deserves recognition, or there's a degree of mischievous, knowingly controversial intent involved, it's an intriguing question.
I don't think that's me, because I don't think I've written about Ed Sheeran before.
Okay, you're right.
Do I think...
It's Alexis Petridis in The Guardian talking about Ed Sheeran being nominated for the Mercury in possibly one of the century's longest sentences. I think
that was long. What year was yeah. that?
I think Divide was nominated for last year's Mercury, so I expect that's the one it was for. Right, yeah. Okay, that's 4 for 4 so far. Final one. It's no coincidence 2014 single Centuries, with its frantic clapping, rousing chants and not-so-tussle sampling of Suzanne Vega's banger Tom's Diner, was used by ESPN to soundtrack their sports coverage. That's the kind of band Fall Out Boy are now, massive in every possible sense.
Okay, I think that might be a cover story I did with Pete Wentz for Notion, but...
It is.
Yes!
It is, which means not only...
I have it on my wall. I don't know if you can see...
Okay. I can.
Yeah, because that was my first cover that I ever got commissioned, so I framed the cover.
Oh, amazing! Yeah. Well, not only are you one of the few people to get 5 out of 5, but I think you've equaled previous guest Laura Snapes' record of not only naming all 5 but knowing what each one of them is about as well. So you're joint top of the leaderboard
so far. Really good game. I actually, when I was when I first moved to London, I did a review for NME, and I showed some of my London friends when it came out, and there was a phrase that one of my mates, who was like a sports reporter, he teased me for, and I referred to one of the songs that this like wanky indie band played as like smoky reverberations, and he was like, that's the cuntiest thing I've ever heard. And he would, it always comes up on Facebook memories, this one time of the year where he'll like mention it to me. He'll be like, oh, are you gonna come out tonight? Like, there'll be no smoky reverberations, but you know. But when I used to do these NME little reviews, they'd be like 100 words. You had to just pack as much information in as you could, so everyone did sort of. But yeah, oh, that was fun. I enjoyed that. That was good.
Glad. Super. Well, that's the end of the quiz and the end of the episode. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do it. I really, awesome. Really enjoyed it, and I can't wait to hear it back as well.
So there we go. Many thanks to Chris Mandel for being this week's guest on Reads Like a Four, the podcast that deals with reviews, critics, and criticism. Thanks so much to him for giving us a little guide to the inner workings of Shortlist and some of the finer points of his career. Next week, we take a left turn into the world of travel. I'll be talking to the destinations editor at Lonely Planet about how they pick countries, how they choose their hotels, whether they get lobbied by people who run restaurants and so on, the dangers that come with travel writing, what happens if they write a guide and the government then tells you you can't fly there, all this and more. Just basically trying to get a look into the world of a industry that effectively reviews entire countries. So more of that next Friday. If you want to follow us on Instagram or Twitter, it's at ReadsLikeA4. You can email readslikea4@gmail.com. And that's all the smoky reverberations we have for this week. So thanks once more for listening, and we will see you next Friday.